that the date is the 10th.
October
18th. 10-18. And it's about 11:30 a.m. And this is Whitney Fletcher Hall with Jenny Trujillo. Okay. So can you describe some of the issues that the Latino community faces in our public schools, such as dropout rate?
Well, I think there's probably three different categories. One is language barriers, two is social barriers, and three is economic barriers. The language barriers, when you think particularly of the migrant families or the immigrants, we of course face language barriers and not being able to speak the English language. And I'll just say a tiny bit about that. They had started, the Drangar Niner School District had started an ESL program that was just run by two aides in response to being cited by the Office of Civil Rights for not serving the needs of these kids after they came down here to respond to a complaint that was made by a Hispanic community member named Marta Enriquez, who felt that her son's miseducation was due to language barriers that had never been addressed in over about 15 years.
What time period are you talking about?
1993.
That was the first institution of ESL.
So, very, very, very behind the times in terms of when civil rights had been implemented, and they went around to like these rural districts and investigated, but only if they were called in by someone. So, 93 school year and 94 school year, they structured that, and it really was an attempt, but really wasn't based on any strong pedagogy practices or anything. So I was recruited from the Farmington District to come here and start an ESL program. And I started that at Park Elementary, where that was the highest concentration of ELL students, which remains today. And it has always remained an ESL program, so there are still some barriers because it's not a bilingual program. It's really an immersion into English program. And you have some statistics on that paper, but we now have at least one ELL student in every single school in Durango, and of course some schools have quite a few. I think the number is almost up to 200 in the district. Then as far as the social barriers that we have faced in the school district have been related to not being allowed to speak Spanish in years past. There's a custodian at Park Elementary who tells stories of being spit on, of being put in timeout, of being hit in the head for speaking the Spanish language. They were made to feel ashamed that it was dirty, that they were dirty, and that it was just not appropriate for school. There was an attitude that it had to do with being poor or uneducated, and it was never something to be proud of. And there are many, 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 many stories, particularly at Park Elementary, because of the location of Santa Rita and of Park, not at the location it is now, but what it used to be before, with Park Mason.
Mm-hmm.
Of those kids really being discriminated against, not only by other students, but by teachers as well.
And do you know how recently that was extended to really atrocious kind of behavior?
The really atrocious kind of behavior, I would say, he's about 55, so that would have put him in elementary school. He is not 55 yet because he hasn't retired. He's about 52, maybe.
Okay.
So you could do some subtraction.
Maybe in the 60s, but then you think that sort of the dirty image has just extended without really harsh.
Teachers no longer say things verbally, but I can tell you my own experience at Park Elementary. I was called the taco teacher when I first got there, so that was as recently as 1995. And we've certainly come a long way. There's a lot of people who are really responsive and care and have good things to say, but there still is a remnant of that discriminatory practice that mainly has to do with assimilation. It's not that you need to feel bad about your culture anymore, it's that you've got to learn to be like dominant culture. And so from my standpoint as an educator, that really put me in a situation where I was underrepresented sometimes, like nobody really cares what we have to say, but then other times for a committee, they'll want a Hispanic last name on the committee just to be politically correct and say that somebody gave input. And at one time I was serving on 11 different committees when I was with the school district because I felt the need to represent.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized when I was there that I really wasn't. What was I really representing? So at a school like Park, they have really come a long way after the 1995 implementation of the ESL program. Padres, which is a support group for minority and linguistically different parents, started at that time. And parent involvement went from 0 to 95%. And that program still remains a strong program today. And so it wasn't a matter of saying that, well, there was still that attitude, like, well, those parents really don't care about their kids or they're not educated enough to care about school. When in fact they did, it was just a matter of finding time when they could come, you know, and could we have daycare and could we have food there, stuff like that. So we still have faced issues in that sense, but the community has been more responsive, and particularly Park, because of its location. Now, in fact, they even teach Spanish as one of the specials, like music or PE, during the school day. It's not an after-school program anymore. So that's something that has sort of come full circle, really, being a school where it was once made to be ashamed, and now it's really responsive. However, the other schools in the area, although we have lots of schools that teach Spanish, none of the Spanish teachers are Hispanic people, nor do they have Spanish as their first language. And they still have a tendency to not really know how to deal with those kids when they come. As far as how what kind of services to give, how often, how much, when, what quality, you know, to just have somebody there is different than have somebody who's trained to work with that group of students. And then the last thing I think of in terms of discrimination has a lot to do with economics, because these kids are still on free lunch, and they're still, you know, you get a homework assignment that has something to do with a computer. You don't have a computer at your house. You might have a parent who has three jobs, not one. And you, therefore, are perhaps playing outside on the street and not as supervised as some other people. So those are the three big areas that I still see. We have a lot of barriers to overcome, and it has a lot to do not just with tolerance, but with understanding. And I don't see that many people, and I haven't seen that many people in my career who were maliciously prejudiced. I have more so encountered people who are ignorant and really don't know. Like I had a principal one time ask me, do you think we should have a separate open house night for the Mexicans and the Indians? And she was thinking that she was being culturally responsive and not realizing how inappropriate of a comment it was.
And then you've mentioned in class 40% dropout rate among high school?
Not in Durango 9R.
Okay.
In the Four Corners area, we even go as high as 60%. But that paper I have given you there shows those statistics, and it's an important distinction for you to make as a researcher, the difference between dropout rate and the difference between graduation rate. Because graduation rate gives you a bigger glimpse into, yeah, if they're not classified as a dropout, then what has happened to them? Are we graduating those kids? Where are they? Are they at the Excel school, Expel school, Phoenix? You know, where are they and what's happening to them? So that gives you a better clue.
Okay, so since I'm looking at this in a historical fashion, and I don't know if you can really answer this, but I'm kind of trying to see who we're discussing here when we discuss these issues. I'm wondering how the older Hispano community is, where they stand in terms of having divorced themselves from this population, or if it tends to be mostly Mexican immigrants, if it's really super diverse. Or
well, the student group that faces the most difficulty in terms of those barriers are the immigrant students. But as we've discussed in class with that continuum and the impacted English that a lot of our Spanish-speaking students speak, that's a large group of students that I would say, as a language expert, are still being overlooked. They're not put into ESL or ELL programs because their parents say, well, we don't speak Spanish, and they don't really feel the need then for their kids to be getting those extra language services. But we are seeing that those kids, if you were to go look at the CSAP scores on the computer, you will find that the Hispanic students are not achieving at the level of their Anglo peers. And that particular group tends to be the, you know, fourth, fifth generation Hispanos that you're referring to as well. And they really don't see their problems as the same as the immigrants. When we had a meeting about three or four weeks ago, I translated at a thing at Sacred Heart Church for a new group that's blossoming off. There was a man who was Mexican-American and standing in front of the church shouting vulgar language at us and calling them wetbacks and things like that. And so that was a very ugly scene within the Latino community, that there are people who feel jealous. It was after all that stuff came out in the Herald about the immigration. You guys are getting all the attention now. We've been here for 100 years and nobody cares about our problems. You know, those were the kind of things he was shouting at us. So it's the language that really separates those two groups of people, because the ones that are more fluent have a tendency to identify in a unified way, and the ones who really have assimilated and speak more English only don't see themselves as the same group. But they still face issues in the schools, and they still face discrimination in this time. In terms of the government or within schools or what?
Well, I guess that's where I was going to break it down after. So, clearly it's not, the problem isn't that there are linguistic barriers, solely that there are linguistic barriers or that there are, you know, economic disadvantages. What's happening is it's interacting with policy making decisions.
Right.
And so I'm wondering...
Mm-hmm. Well, I could speak to it certainly in terms of education. You might need to obviously ask some other people, other areas of expertise.
Oh, yeah.
But when Colorado became an English-only state, we are still allowed to have transitional bilingual programs. But our money that's from the English Language Proficiency Act is only given to us to work with these linguistically different students for 2 years. And for you to transition and become totally fluent in a language, you're talking about a minimum of 5 years. So that's 3 years worth of money, and to tell you the truth, high pressure to get those kids out of those programs and into English language. And we see a lot of those kids sinking, you know, once they're out. In terms of policy things, one thing that might be on the positive side and not on the negative side is that we have that Filer versus Doe case that shows that you can only ask for immunization records and birth certificate. And so that's something that where that lack of awareness comes in, and we see discriminatory behavior from people saying, well, you're not going to get enrolled in school till we see your proof of citizenship, or a social, you can't get your free lunch unless we see a social security number for your parents. So those kind of things are really actually illegal to be asking,
right.
But yet people don't always recognize that.
And that's a policy.
And that's a policy.
Okay, that's great. So where do these policies such as English only state stuff, where do they come from?
Well, that's a huge question, Whitney. Officially, they come from a legislator who sponsors a bill or an act for your state to become, and now 23 states, you have to double check, because it went from 17 to 22 to 23, it could be as high as 25 now, states have declared English as the official language. And so you could look up the language of it, but that's, in terms of your question about policy, you probably know something about it, because it means no more driver's license tests in Spanish, no civil ceremonies. And I'm using Spanish as the example, but in any language other than English, cannot be done. You can't, it really can hurt you in the court system. There are major, major, major implications that are discriminatory and, frankly, prejudice. I find no other word for it than prejudice.
So that actually has really serious implications as far as other aspects. Because right now I know that they want to have, they're trying to get Spanish-speaking people in a lot of different categories. At the courthouse for whatever, here or there.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, that's not supposed to be allowed under English.
Well, what happens is that you have a difference between federal policy and state policy. And the federal government has never declared English only. If you do some research in about the history of English policy, English language policy, the quote-unquote forefathers types never wanted to legislate language because it has always been a diverse nation and there was never a need. Knowing more than one language was considered a benefit. It was never until recently considered un-American to not speak the English language or to speak another language besides. So that's why we see some different policies, and that's why we can still have bilingual education in the schools, even if it's an English-only state, because it's a federal policy in the state.
So, how to bring it more locally, how does the community of Durango affect how the experience for the Latino community is in the schools? I mean, I know you said it's more ignorance than English is different, but.
Well, again, thinking about the Santa Rita area and the people, the Hispanos who have been here for a long time, they have certainly maintained a sense of heritage. And using Park School as an example, again, only because of their location in the community, being close to Santa Rita and those areas, they are going on their 23rd year of the Cinco de Mayo celebration at the school. And so about six or seven, I'd say 7 years ago, the community, there was a group of community members made up of not only immigrants, but Mexican-Americans, but local Hispanics who've been here for years, who said, "Hey, you know, we used to have a really good time with our Cinco de Mayo stuff. Let's get that going again at the community level." So we've seen an embracing of that. We've seen more of an awareness of culture in a positive sense, where people are going back and saying, "You know what, nobody spits on me for being Mexican now. I think it's okay for me to show that I'm proud of both of my cultures and who I am." And with that awareness has come some power, because as we saw in the last city council elections, we were able to register people to vote. And now to not just be heard in our parks and in our streets, but at a political level.
Mm-hmm.
So my sense of the community of Durango is that things were going fine when we were just being quiet and saying, let them have their little parades and parties type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when we saw some decision-making power, right, and some real control, the Durango Latino Education Coalition saying, put us on the hiring committees for Durango 9R teachers. Why do you have this huge population of Hispanos and no Hispanic teachers in your district? And so when we started trying to pull some muscle, then we've seen a little bit of the hesitation again.
Mm-hmm.
I have had to go and speak four separate times to a parent organization at Park Elementary to explain what Cinco de Mayo is, why it's not divisive, and why we still deserve the chance to celebrate it. And I feel, as you asked me to look at the local perspective, that that has been a direct influence of our state migration from California. We have a lot of people in this town who left California specifically for political reasons,
mm-hmm.
and who do not want to see Spanish becoming a part of the schools in this area.
Oh, you mean the greater Durango community, black people from California?
Yes. And that's my experience with talking to those PTO groups and trying to rationalize and explain to them it's something unifying. It's a tradition at that particular school and in that particular area, just the same as 4th of July or St. Patrick's Day or the Halloween carnival we'll be having this week. It happens to be an ethnic holiday, but it doesn't negate it in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So we do see some of that resistance coming back up now that we're becoming more visible. I'll also tell you that the Durango Herald actually had people discontinue their subscription
mm-hmm.
because of the attention to the immigration issues in this area.
Okay. So do you find that it tends to be more the community versus the teachers or city council or when you experience this resistance, or is it just pretty much wherever?
It's as it comes, because no one group could I make a blanket statement about.
Right.
And there are teachers within the district who still have issues with those kids in a malicious way or in an ignorant way. And there are people at every level I've encountered in a variety of settings. But there's no there's not a blanket discrimination like there used to be, like the Elks Lodge not being allowed to be a member of the Elks Lodge if you were an Hispanic, things like that. So there's no blatant things like that anymore, but that's not to say that you don't experience. You do.
Well, I guess that's kind of the point of my project, is that people tend to want to say, look, it's changed, because it's not a good book, but obviously it's operating as a profession. Okay, well then I guess the last thing I want to know, which is what you were kind of talking about, is what you've seen as historic changes. I know you've been here forever, but...
In terms of what group?
Still within the schools and
like just the larger Hispanic community total.
Right, in their interaction with the schools. And I guess that we've already talked about the other initial contact places.
Well, I guess the main thing I would say about that in closing is that our demographic changes are happening in two ways. One, that the Hispanic birth rate, I think you have it on that statistics page I gave you near the top. But that is having already a major impact in the school system. And number two, not just the local Hispanos, but the immigration that we're seeing is bringing those language variables very strongly into the schools. People who haven't been willing to deal with it, it's fine for them to let six or seven kids fall through the cracks, but if all of a sudden in a first grade classroom out of 18 kids, eight of them are Hispanos who possibly have linguistic barriers, you have to be forced to do something to deal with those kids. The third thing that's happening is that for all the negative publicity that the Colorado State Assessment Program gets, the CSAP, it has forced people to look at that group of kids and say, hey, our scores are going to be pulled down by these kids, so we better try to be doing something for this group of students. So my perspective as a minority person in this area is that CSAP has not been a totally negative thing, because it has brought to light, hey, by the way, these kids are failing and someone's, it's unacceptable. So those changes in numbers are forcing people to do more about it than they perhaps would have just turned the other way in the past.
Well, this is super helpful because I wasn't really sure where to look, and so maybe you can open this up for me and stuff, but